Welcome to episode 22 of About Nashville. I'm Mike Rogers. Thank you, everybody, for listening to my podcast. Today's guest is David Hudson, who is a successful attorney. He's an author of over 40 published books and a professional boxing judge. I've known David for over 20 years, or almost 20 years, anyway. We've talked about TV shows, how we met, boxing, his books, and then he went out in my backyard and beat me at cornhole. Damn it, son of a bitch. You know, everything ties into Nashville, and the premise of the show is about Nashville and the people and talented people that come through it. Well, one of the people that came through it is boxing on TV this weekend. Deontay Wilder is fighting Chris Areola. I met Deontay Wilder in, I guess, 2008 when he made his professional debut on the undercard of Jermaine Taylor, defending his middleweight championship of the world. And I will find a way to get Deontay Wilder on the show. But Deontay Wilder, check him out this weekend on Fox Television this Saturday, July 16th. Deontay Wilder versus Chris Areola for the WBC Heavyweight Championship of the World. Check it out, guys. He will be on the show. I will find a way somehow or another to make that happen. So how'd your date go, Holly, with the hockey player? Did it get pucked up?
Before we go into that, how cool is it to have a name like Areola?
It could be like Deontay Sphincter versus Chris Areola. I don't know.
I would love to have that.
Deontay would kick my ass too. He's like 6'7", 240 pounds. He would beat me like a broken a church.
Well, that's okay. Sorry.
No, it ain't okay. He's big dude. He'd hurt me. He'd hurt me bad.
Well, back in your day, I'm sure you would have kicked his ass.
Back in my day, I could have just run faster.
So my date. You know what? It actually went well.
Really?
He brought his wallet. He paid for the date. He was a complete gentleman.
Talked about baseball?
No.
Did he talk about hockey?
No.
What did he talk about?
He just wanted to get to know me. I was shocked.
Did you really? He took you where?
He knows I'm vegan.
Okay, I know you're vegan.
He took me to a vegan restaurant.
Are you completely vegan or just attempting vegan?
Completely.
Okay, so how long have you been a vegan?
I've been vegetarian for about 2 years. Vegan, about 30 days. A little bit over 30 days.
So you don't take beef at all anymore?
No beef.
No sausage.
No sausage. No.
Okay. All right. So that would be rough. I don't think I could do that. I just don't. I think I like the idea of it, but the idea of having to go out and find my food and find things that would be just as good, I would struggle with that.
I do. So that's the hardest part.
It is.
But it's all mental.
Well, then you got to buy for yourself, and then you got to buy for everybody else in your household too.
You do. But no, they
it's gotta be expensive.
They eat what I eat. It's really not. And now I'm in the process of trying to grow a garden.
Really?
Yeah, I am.
You growing weed in it?
Maybe. Maybe.
Oh gosh.
But it was a really, really good day.
Trying to get a green thumb. What made it so good?
That he wanted to know me.
Really?
Like I hadn't had that in a long time.
Did you let him really know you, or did you just let him know you wanted him to know?
Exactly.
I got you.
No, but he actually,
that's the dating process.
But he took the initiative to find a vegan restaurant. That was so impressive.
That
he
is.
He easily took me to a steakhouse and told me to fucking find something vegan on the menu.
Right, right. So when are y'all going out again?
You know, when I get in situations like that, I get scared.
Mm-hmm.
So, I hadn't set anything up yet.
Mm-hmm.
I have to kind of...
Do you have to set it up, or does he have to set it up? Has he asked?
He has.
And you've said no?
And I push back.
Okay. That just makes him want you more.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So, I should have gave him some ass the first night, and then he would have been done with it, right?
Well, no. I mean, it depends. If that ass is real good, he'll be calling you every night. You really can't, because there's power in the puss. There's truly power in the puss. Think about this for a minute. You think about the whole terrorism thing. Why do men go out and do terrorist acts? Because they think they're going to get 99 virgins or virgins or whatever it is.
And very true.
How many
very
women true. Terrorists do you see? There ain't no power in the dick.
None at all.
The power is in the puss. I'm telling you right now, y'all have all the power.
That's great. All right. If I do.
I'm telling you now, we need to get on to this interview with David Hudson. Dream big, everybody.
I'm a knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the honky-tonk. honky tonk hit man.
Welcome to About Nashville with your host, the Honky Tonk Hitman, Mike Rogers.
When did you start going to bouts at the Mix Factory?
I don't even remember the exact date. I know it was 1997. I remember driving down downtown Nashville, looked on the side of the road and saw the banner. It said live pro boxing, rings, come get a ringside seat. And I thankfully, just on a pure whim, pulled in the parking lot, walked across the street. They said general admission $10, ringside seat $25. So I paid $25 to get a ringside seat. Sitting up front, I got there a little early and had a conversation with a guy that you'll remember, Charles Wilfell.
Okay.
Charles, give him hell, Wilfell, who was one of the judges there, and he was impressed that I had a lot of passion and seemed to know something about the sport. And we resonated with each other, I suppose, and he took a liking to me and was sort of a mentor. He let me guest judge that night.
So
he
had a guest judge.
And of course, most of the fights ended in knockouts. There was some guy that came in with a cowboy hat and boots, this legendary, became kind of a mythical figure named Mike the Honky Tonk Hitman Rogers, came in knocking people out.
Yeah.
And but a few of the fights went to decision, and my scorecards matched his, and then he recommended me to commissioner. I ended up getting a license, I think, in late 97 or early 98, so it was a nice way for me to become closer to the boxing world, because it's a sport that, unlike you, I wasn't doing it when I was 4 years old, but it was a sport that it's something we share. We share a passion for the sport of boxing, the sport of kings.
What was
sweet
the first,
science.
What was the first fight you saw me in, or that you remember?
Ooh, I saw several. The one that stays in my mind was a really tough guy. Jeremy was his first name. I can't remember his last name. He was a big, tough-looking guy, and I'd never seen you before. And at that time, you only weighed about 160-something pounds. You were not terribly physically imposing.
Mm-hmm. I'm still not.
Yeah.
Even at the
so,
day, I'm not.
You know,
yeah.
But you already had a little bit of a cult following. But I didn't know who was going to win, obviously, and I don't think I was a judge then. I think I was purely as a spectator at that point in time. And this guy comes charging at you, throwing sort of roundhouse. He looked like a kind of a tough man type fighter, and you hit him with a right uppercut, and you literally lifted the man off the canvas and knocked him out. And that to me was the beginning of the legend of the Honky Tonk Hitman. Because my understanding, I got to write about this for Boxing Digest, is that you had about a 175-225 amateur bouts. I don't know. You had a stellar.
Yeah, it was close to 200 bouts.
You had about 200 amateur bouts, but nobody knew that. And so you were brought in as the opponent to lose.
Yeah, several occasions.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to me.
Yeah, and that was really kind of shocking to see this guy with the cowboy hat. I thought you were like a country musician, which it turned out you were that too. But when you knocked him flat out, that was a pivotal moment for me. And then I never imagined we'd become best of friends, which is even better. The other fighter that stood out in my mind was the incomparable Reggie Strickland, who I believe has lost more professional fights than any fighter in boxing history. I think he has
still, to this day,
268 losses.
You know, and that might be a record that'll never be broken.
I don't think it will.
Yeah, because of all the
well, he fought under different aliases. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes he was Reggie Strickland, sometimes Reggie Ragland, sometimes Reggie Buse.
Well, that's not the first person to do that.
There were times, though, where he would have back-to-back fights on different nights. I mean, this guy, and he was a good defensive fighter. You know this better than me, but he was a good defensive fighter, and so most of the time he just lost by decision. Mm-hmm. And if you lose by decision, they don't ever suspend you usually, right? Mm-hmm. If you get stopped, it's like usually a 30-day suspension. So he mastered the art of doing enough to not get knocked out. He had enough defensive skills, I assume, and he became the perennial opponent. And the New York Times actually ran a front page story on him in '98 or '99.
That's how you get punchy, though.
Yeah.
Bruce the Mouse Strauss, did the same thing.
They had a profile of him in the Sports Illustrated. He became so well known. But I've always had a certain fondness for the ultimate opponent, the Reggie Stricklands, the Bruce Sprouses, Simi Blacks, those who came in, were brought in, and were opponents. But those are the good old days.
Golly, I know. And it was crazy.
We had a professional fight card every week of the year, except maybe Christmas and maybe mm-hmm. another year. I mean, to give Jimmy Abbs credit, I mean, somehow they managed to put together a fight card every week. And my recollection is that every Thursday night. And so I actually look forward to Thursday night.
And there were some big names on some of these
Greg calls. Page was there, the late Greg Page.
Oliver
God
McCall.
Rest his soul. Oliver McCall, Tony Tucker, Steve Purnell, Theo Elmore.
Yeah.
I mean, Danny Batchelder came in there and fought. It was just a lot of... Tuan Taylor,
Reed,
Jonathan
Tawan
Reed, Dog Taylor. Reed. Yeah, there were some good. There were some big names came through there.
I saw Tuan Taylor fighting at a Mexican restaurant not too long ago, and it broke my heart. It broke my heart.
I was there. Yeah.
And I'll tell you a funny story about. I had like three or four pro fights at this particular point, and Tuan had he was a winning record. He was an imposing looking figure and everything. And he came up to me, and I wouldn't pay the extra money. I wouldn't, and I couldn't afford it. I wouldn't wear the boxing boots that they had for everybody for my tennis shoes. And he was like, "Dude, you need some boxing boots." I said, "I can't afford them." He said, "Dude, you are a fighter." He said, "Use mine," and he let me use my boots. I let him use his boots for the bout. I just never forgot that, And he was just such a kind guy, and it just kind of broke my heart that he's still out there fighting, 20 years later, 20 years later. I mean, this is, we're creeping up on it, man. And it just broke my heart.
Yeah.
But that's just the fight game. I mean, I have such a love-hate relationship with the fight game. I love everything about the fighters. I love everything about everything that goes on in the gym. I love everything that goes on in the ring. It's all the politics and bullshit that happens outside.
Do your listeners know who your father is?
They do from an episode I did with Tom Segura. We talked a lot about that. I actually interviewed my dad. I just haven't put it out yet. He's one of the best cut men of all time,
So where do you rank Muhammad Ali in the annals of boxing history as heavyweights?
You mean pound for pound?
Well, I think just the heavyweight division.
Well,
where is he?
But even then you'd have to say pound for pound, because you'd have to take, there's some things that you'd have to take in perspective. Like, I don't think that Ali would have done very well versus a Vladimir Klitschko or a...
You don't think the Ali of 66, 67, I think he may have handled anybody.
No, absolutely.
Because if you remember, Ernie Terrell was 6'6", 6'7".
It doesn't matter. Mm. So is Jess Willard. Mm. And, Ali would have killed Jess Willard.
Mm.
It's the difference between how, the conditioning and the things that people have available to them and learning different skill sets and learning to fight tall and learning, it's just a different...
The speed that he had in his prime. We never got to see him really in his prime. If you think about it, he was stripped of the title and was in exile for 3.5 years. That fighter from 66 to 67 was almost untouchable. The blazing speed.
People are going to get mad at me for saying that, but here's the thing, and this is where we have to be truthful with each other. The greatest football team on the face of the planet in 1975 could not beat the greatest football team in 1985. Just like 1985 couldn't beat the best team in 1995. Things change that much. People get bigger, they get stronger, they get faster.
Wilton Norman Chamberlain. who in the existing NBA is as strong or as powerful as Wilton Norman Chamberlain?
But he was only one guy, and he would have been surrounded by other mediocre players. No. You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. There was always the exception to the rule, but you're still surrounded by the mediocrity of that period. And then when you surround the mediocrity of our period, of the current day period, if you take a look at like a LeBron James or somebody like that to compete against him, and then you add him, you know, with these all these other top-notch guys that are surrounding with the team, it would be very hard. You don't play basketball one person versus one person. You know,
it's kind of like Arkansas or LSU having to go up against the Crimson Tide. You know, you have the best, and you have the rest.
I mean, you really, you know, it is the truth. I mean, the Crimson Tide is a fantastic program, and it all is due to, you know, Nick Saban. they always say that he did the same thing for LSU. So I really can't, you know, knock it. He really is a fantastic football coach, and he's a great recruiter. I think it's unfair for, you know, boxers to be compared out of generations. You know, I hear all the time, Sugar Ray Robinson was the greatest boxer of all time ever to put on the gloves, and that's why I said pound for pound, because if you were to take those other things into consideration, you know, It makes a difference. It makes a big difference. And I heard all the time, you know, what about Rocky Marciano? Rocky Marciano handled Muhammad Ali. Rocky Marciano knocked his ass out. Rocky Marciano couldn't have touched him with a 10-foot pole. I love Rocky Marciano. I thought Rocky Marciano was a very explosive fighter. He was a great fighter. But ultimately, Rocky Marciano would not have been able to lay gloves on Muhammad Ali.
But 49-0 is 49-0.
Yeah. So you can't knock that. You can't judge that. He was great for his period.
Yeah, well said.
But, you know, it's just not fair to try to take him out of that and then compare him to what Ali and them were doing in that era. So, you know, it's the same with today and with fighters today. Regardless, in his era, and for what he accomplished in heavyweight boxing, I would still put him at number one. A very close number one. Maybe number two. I probably might have him in. I still think Joe Louis might have been better. Comparatively, I'm not talking about Joe Louis versus Muhammad Ali. Sure. I'm talking about what he accomplished and how long he accomplished it and all the title defenses and all of the, you know, the things that he did. So, yeah, I probably would put Joe Louis number one and I would put Ali number two. But that, once again, I'm not comparing skills. I'm talking about accomplishments and what they did in their time frames and with who they did it with. Although, you know, Joe Louis had his bum of the month club, so... So what's your take on the whole heavyweight division nowadays? I mean, are you a big fan of the heavyweight division now?
I'm just a fan of boxing anytime. I just love boxing. Also like mixed martial arts. I mean, the courage, that's why I admire you so much, the courage it takes to walk in that ring. I admire any fighter.
I'll be honest with you. If mixed martial arts had been popular when I was a kid, I probably would have done that. Ultimately, because I would have loved to wrestle. I would have loved to do jiu-jitsu, and obviously my stand-up game is strong. So I could see myself doing.
And you're tough. That's one thing. I don't know if everyone knows how tough you are. Well, every obstacle in life, you somehow managed to overcome it, and you've had your fair share.
I don't know that boxing taught me that. I think that's innate. I think we're all born with that at some level. I mean, even I'll use this for an example. When I was 5 years old, I had my very first boxing match, and this was in a world when you didn't wear tank tops, you didn't wear headgear. They were three rounds. You did not have standing eight counts, and it was like a three-round pro fight. And there was nobody my age to fight, so I fought an 8-year-old. And I believe the kid knocked me down like 5 or 6 times in that first round.
Yeah, but what did your daddy say you kept getting back up
every
single time?
Absolutely. I kept getting back up, and I even went back to the corner after the first round, and my dad was like, son, do you want to quit? Have you had enough? And I'm like, I'm just getting started. This is, we're going here.
But don't you think your boxing experience helped you with discipline in general?
Absolutely.
Probably helped you face difficult circumstances. I mean, it does take an indelible amount of courage to step in that ring when people are trying to take your head off.
I agree.
The discipline of training.
I don't think you train. No. Maybe discipline. I learned discipline. But you don't train tough. I think you're either born tough or you're not. You know, I may be wrong. Maybe I could be proven wrong. Mm. But I was tough at 4 and 5 and have been that way my entire life. I unless somebody could give me another example of something that maybe I'm not missing, but, I use this for an example. When I was in first grade, and I don't know how old you are. How old are you in first grade? Five-year-old? Six-year-old?
Six years old.
The teacher, it was raining, pouring down rain, just like storming and thundering and everything. And this lady, Mrs. Johnson, who was our teacher, she accused me. Well, I think I got into it with another kid. He messed with me. I punched him. And then he told her I started it. She put me off in the corner. And I'm like, fuck this shit. And I grabbed my, I don't think I didn't say that, but I was thinking it. And I grabbed my jacket and I walked off into a rainstorm because I was right there by the back door and left and tried to hitchhike home. I got halfway home, still hitchhiking, was about to get into a truck. This is 6 years old. My daughter's six. I'm looking at her going, that would never happen. I was a different breed. And I was about to get in there, rain pouring down, my dad flying out. Michael David, get your ass in the car.
So that's a good song title for you, A Different Breed. Yeah. I like that. Right. Autobiographical.
I was a completely different breed. So I can't even imagine a kid that headstrong today doing something like that. It's like I said, I think that you're either born that way or you're not. You know, it's not, you don't go, I don't think you set out in life going, I'm going to be tough, or I'm going to train to be tough, or I just think you are or you're not. I mean, do you think that that's something you can train to be?
I certainly think you can improve. I do think some of it is innate, but I think it can be developed.
Okay.
I think you can learn toughness. You know, like the first time you get a bloody nose. I remember the first time I got a bloody nose, I freaked out. Now I get a bloody nose. Doesn't happen that often. But the last time I got a bloody nose doing a little bit of sparring, it didn't completely freak me out.
Right,
I've had a bloody nose before. But
when you said you freaked out, what, you done like shit on yourself or something?
Well, I mean, I felt like it, yeah. Like, what's going on here? Get me out of here, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Were you scared?
Yeah, probably so. Yeah. But it was in karate. I can't remember the kid's name.
Taekwondo. Oh, so you were a kid.
Yeah, I was a kid.
Okay. So you coming out there to the Mixed Factory, that's what got you into working professional boxing.
That's correct. Because those were professional boxing bouts. That's where I got my boxing license. I've subsequently worked amateur bouts as well, but it's professional boxing's always been a love of mine.
So do you remember how we met?
Oh gosh. Okay.
See if you tell the story right.
Well, I met you one time at the Mix Factory, but I was just one of many people, so I don't think you recall that. But where we really bonded was in Little Rock, Arkansas, if I recall.
No. No. So I got a woman pregnant. And
you're talking about at Vanderbilt?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I do remember this. Yesterday, I'm going to work for 17 years, and it's really a true blessing for me that for 17 years of my life, I got to work for John Sigenthaler Sr., who's a legendary figure in his own right. He was special assistant to then Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He was editor and publisher of the Tennessean for 40-some-odd years. He was a pioneering figure in civil rights and freedom of the press and the First Amendment. He was the founder of the First Amendment Center. I got to work there from 1995 until early 2013. I still do some writing for them, and that's where I developed my expertise in First Amendment free speech issues. But I pull into the parking lot, get out, and I'm walking up there, and lo and behold, you and Larry, I think his name was Larry. Larry was a good dude.
They called him King.
Yeah, and you were picking up, you were making the place cleaner.
I was the only white yard cleaner.
And you looked slightly embarrassed, but I walked up. I said, "You know who that is? That's the Honky Tonk Hitman."
Yes.
I said, "Don't make him mad. He'll knock you out." And you kind of looked at me like I was silly, but I think you appreciated that I could care less if you were picking up the garbage or if you were president of the organization, that it mattered to me.
I was developing this whole persona, and my ex-wife was like, "You're no longer going to box, you're no longer going to sing, you need to go get a real job." So I ended up working for this temp agency that put me out there, and
I do remember that.
I kept breaking shit. I wasn't very good at doing that kind of thing, you know, and so they put me up to picking up garbage and shit. So they're like, and you said to him, you said, "Do you know who this is? This is the Honky Tonk Hitman. He can knock people out." And he looked at you and he said, "Good, because he can't wheezy worth a shit."
Yeah, that was awesome.
And
I do remember that. Yeah.
And I was like, "Can I just crawl into?"
So that was pre-Caterpillar.
Yeah, that was pre-Caterpillar. Yeah, yeah.
Because then for many years we only worked a couple blocks away. You were on Caterpillar and West End, and I was on 18th Avenue South at the First Amendment Center.
So this is how I got over to Caterpillar. So that gig got taken away from me, and then they were like, the agency was like, "Well, hey, we got a job working in a mail room at Cat. You need to, you know, go over there and report." So I did. And I showed up, and I'm wearing combat boots, I'm wearing these torn up jeans, I'm wearing a wife beater, and I'm wearing a do-rag. And I show up, and they look at me like, "What the hell has just walked in here?"
You end up being a manager.
Well, hold on. So they're like, "What the hell has just walked in here?" And I'm like, everybody else has got suit and ties on. And I was like, "Why is everybody dressed up?" Because this is a corporate building, and we're gonna let you work back here, we're gonna let you hide back here, but when you come back here tomorrow, you need to be wearing dress pants, dress shirt, and a tie. So I went to Target and I bought a pair of black shoes, pair of black pants, a white shirt, and a black tie. And that's what I wore every day until I got another paycheck and could get another.
And you had the little Secret of My Success Michael J. Fox character going there for a while,
yeah.
Moving from the mailroom to the management.
So I did. I went from the mailroom to working into optical imaging, from optical imaging to managing the whole dadgum thing, and then ended up learning so much about it that I ended up, putting it all over the world, you know, for Caterpillar Financial. But what most people don't get and what they don't see, and I'm just looking around to see if there's a picture in here, but if you remember when I first started off my amateur boxing team, one of the goals that I wanted to teach them when we went off and competed was I knew, or I believed and felt like it didn't matter if I ever taught a professional boxer, or if I ever taught a person to win a big tournament or whatever else. I wanted to teach them the skills that I used in boxing for them to relearn that and use that in life.
Yeah.
And so I would make them, and nobody got this, and they might not get it till now when they hear this, and we're like, "Oh my gosh, that's why he made us do all
but
that."
But you commanded respect.
Oh, yeah.
That was enough around there. They called you coach and yes, sir.
Absolutely. So so then they all had to wear white shirts, black ties, black pants, and we all, that's how, and then you had to wear your hair a certain way, and that's how we went and competed. As a matter of fact, when we first started showing up at places, they started calling us choir boys, and then when we started kicking their ass and every single thing,
they'd be good fighters. Kevin's done a good job with that,
absolutely,
too. Kevin Bay. Page. Kevin Shout Page. Out to Kevin Page.
Shout
man.
Out, man.
Good dude.
He has taken the program and continued to run with it. And
but since we're strolling down memory lane, I have another memory. Oh, and this is about the first time that we met socially after work. And I guess you thought that this little nerd with glasses was not going to be able to shoot some pool. Mm-hmm. And so we went and shot some pool. And do you remember what happened when we shot pool?
You beat me.
Yeah, so then we had to go place. We had to go find a game that you could win at so you could trounce me, I think, in like video golf or something.
I got another game I can beat you at now, too.
What's that?
Cornhole.
No, no way.
I got a set in the backyard.
No way.
All right, we'll put money on it.
Oh, yeah.
We'll put money on it.
Yeah.
Why are you pulling your money out of your wallet now?
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
okay, so
after, no way. There's no way.
All right, so after the interview,
no
I've
chance.
Got a cornhole set in the
no
back.
No chance. Can I come back on here so we can discuss the results of this?
What I will do is I'll be honest enough so that whenever the interview view's over, you know, and then Holly and I do our spot that opens the show, I will let the world know whether, you know, I won or lost.
Isn't there another name for that game? Do we have to call it cornhole?
Well, it's my prison term.
Oh, okay.
It's prison term. You know, anybody that my whole thing, I don't know, it's a terrible joke, but I was just going to say that, you know, everybody that goes to prison thinks they're going to be Batman, but some of them end up being Robin.
Oh, boy. Well, we have to talk a little bit about The Wire, because that's another reason that we bonded, was our innate love of the greatest show in television history.
Sopranos.
Yeah, but The Wire, greatest show in television history.
Absolutely.
Bar none.
They
actually have courses on The Wire at different law schools and college universities. Ivy League colleges have.
I would absolutely say that the Wire was a fantastic, absolutely fantastic show. I would go so far to say that it is, and definitely my top three, definitely my one of my top three. I would say with me it'd be The Wire, it'd be Breaking Bad, and Sopranos.
You know, I actually like Better Call Saul, the prequel.
God.
I like it better than Breaking Bad because I love Jimmy McGill, a character.
Bobby Odenkirk.
I love seeing the backstory of Mike and Saul and everything. I love that show.
Apparently, they're going to intertwine the worlds. They're going to, eventually the worlds will come together and they'll all be, you know, together.
Before. Will like Gus come on Better Call Saul? Will there be Gus?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Gus. Let's see. The guy with the bell, ding 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 ding. He's already come on.
No, Gus is the mastermind.
No, I know. But
T.O. Yeah, T.O.
Yeah, him. Yeah. He's already come on.
The uncle.
And the cousins. Oh, they've already been on there.
Yeah. Love that show. I love the idea of the prequel too.
Now wait a minute. Who came up with the idea for the prequel for The Wire?
You did. How did Avon Barksdale and Stringer Bell come to power? That
and
was your
take
idea.
Over the whole thing.
That would be remarkable if they would do that.
I mean, I think that it would be as big as The Wire. I mean, I think that they could do the same thing.
You know what's sad was The Wire was not that popular in terms of sheer numbers. Now it got incredible critical acclaim.
Had a cult following.
But it did not have the mass following as, say, The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was probably the most popular series, at least at one time. Now, Game of Thrones, I think, probably has overtaken all of them in terms of sheer popularity. But
Speaking of which, are you a big Game of Thrones fan?
No, absolutely. They're actually going to have a national convention, fan convention here next July.
No.
So we're going.
We are?
Yeah, we're going.
Are you like, okay, I'm in.
Let's do it.
Are we going to dress up?
I'll do it if you do it.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll go as Tyrion.
Yeah. All right.
I'll put some boots on my knees and I'll walk around. I got this whole thing figured out.
Yeah.
I do. I absolutely love the show. How do you think it's going to end up?
I don't know. I mean, I've always gotten the impression that Daenerys Targaryen is George Martin's favorite character. You get that impression. So, I mean, the one answer would be that she does cross the Narrow Sea and takes over with her dragons. But now that Jon Snow is half Targaryen, so yeah. They're cousins?
She's his aunt.
She's his aunt. Okay, I can't figure out the...
So that makes him first in line.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting. I don't even want to try to speculate. I just want to watch it.
But I think
it was season 6, episode 8, when Arya comes back, she's killed the Waif, mm-hmm. and she comes in there, and then Jacqueline says, "Finally, a girl is no one."
Yes.
And that line, "A girl is Arya Stark of Winterfell, and I'm going home." I mean, I had to replay that like 10 times. I mean,
he said that shit because he knew he was about to die.
Yeah, it was awesome. Love that show.
So I wonder if the whole time he did all of that just to prepare her.
One theory circulating on the internet is he's the reincarnation, so to speak, Sylvia Farrell, her initial sword master teacher, but
really?
I don't know. Who knows?
I think that's a little odd.
I mean, a lot of the stuff on, you know, Mr. Martin has not he's been a bit dilatory in cranking out these last two books. So.
How quite pedantic are you with these words? So the funny part about it is, you know, he has not written where this whole thing is going to go, but he's kind of just told the writers, this is how I'm going to
end up. At least he's a consultant.
He just says, this is how I'm going to end this whole thing up, and they're just kind of following him in on that. So, which is, a good thing. Works that way. Speaking of which, is there any other shows that you're just like geeking out on?
Ray Donovan. I love Ray Donovan.
Oh, I love Ray Donovan.
Yeah, that show to me... I think the performance of John Voight as Ray Donovan's father, Mickey, is one of the finest performances I've seen in the last 5 years. I mean, he has that character down to a T.
I think it's him, though.
Maybe. I don't know him at all, but he's a phenomenal actor in that role.
Yeah, you can't knock anything from him. He's an Academy Award
winner. The scene that sticks out in my mind is... when Cookie Brown, it flashes on the news that Cookie Brown, the music producer, has been killed in mm-hmm. his own home. And the scene flashes to Abby, Ray Donovan's wife. Mm-hmm. Connor, I think, calls her in there. "Look, Mom, have you seen this?" And she's sitting down on her bed, and you can see the look on her face, and she's processing. There's a slight smile appears on her face, and she processes the fact, Ray Donovan did that. Ray did that for us to protect his family.
That's awesome.
And that, to me, was the most moving scene I've seen.
And you know you've seen a great actor when they can convey certain things to you and never have to say a word. That's amazing.
That's right. Leif Schreiber, I didn't realize this, but his brother is the guy that plays Pornstache in Orange is the New Black.
Ah, okay.
So he's also a good actor.
So do you recognize who his wife is?
No. Abby.
She's from Deadwood. She's the whore.
I never watched Deadwood.
What?
That was not a show that I watched.
So, really?
Yeah.
Dude.
I got to watch Deadwood.
Yeah.
It only lasted 3 seasons.
It's okay.
But I did love Justified. Tell me you watched Justified.
Oh, yeah. One of the great ending.
If you could get this guy on the show, I mean, if you could get this guy on the phone, I would. Walton Goggins, I think, is one of the finest actors in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
He played Boyd Crowder on Justified, and he played Shane Vendrell in The Shield, and he was in The Hateful Eight. That guy, to me,
he's also
in Vice Principals with Danny McBride. He is the finest, and he was on Sons of Anarchy. He is about the finest actor that I can imagine. I think he's from Atlanta, Tennessee. And when The Hateful Eight was first shown...
Did you say Atlanta, Tennessee?
Atlanta, Georgia. I'm sorry. He actually came to Thoroughbred Cinema in Franklin, Tennessee, and was actually at the theater. But that guy... I'm not a hero worshiper,
mm-hmm.
Aside from you and Allen Iverson. But that guy, Walton Goggins, is my favorite actor.
I would love.
But that ending in Justified, we dug coal together. Mm. Right? That was phenomenal. I mean, Justified is up there for me. It's in my top 5.
Yeah.
But the reason I said that is the guy that plays Timothy Olyphant, who plays Raylan Givens, is also in Deadwood, as I understand it. So
it,
I love
it. It might be in my top five. I mean, there's just been so many good things since Oz. Yeah. You know, Oz was kind of like the one that broke it for everybody.
Yeah.
And you know,
I mean, every time now when I can't pronounce his last name, but when the guy that plays Adebisi, some people get into a character so much, I'll see him and I'll think that's Adebisi.
Yeah,
you know, because Adebisi was in Game of Thrones for just he captured Jorah Mormont and Tyrion. When they first, I can't remember where they were exactly, but that's who captured them, was Adebisi.
Oh, cool.
The guy that played Adebisi in Oz. But Adebisi, Saeed, Beecher, mm-hmm. you know, those characters, Keller, I mean, those characters really resonated with me. I guess particularly Beecher, because he's a lawyer. He did something really, really wrong. He goes to jail, and then, you know, he has to figure out how to survive. And then
he takes it in the ass.
Well, he does a lot of bad things, but he ends up crapping on Schillinger's face, remember? I mean, he ends up, you know, I mean, taking a dump right on his face.
Oh, my God. That's pretty funny. And no, you do not take it up in the ass. I was just.
No, I don't. Beecher did, but
yes, Beecher did. So, you been to any good movies lately?
No, I was just talking to that with my wife, Carla. I have not been to a movie, and I don't know how long. I can't even remember the last movie I saw.
Really?
I worry that there are not as many good movies coming out.
No.
And I have gotten pickier through the years. I mean, the last one I remember is the one Johnny Depp was in, who played the Whitey Bulger.
Black Mass.
That was good. I enjoyed that.
So you have been to the movies lately.
Well, that was a while ago. That was 6 months ago, maybe, at least.
Yeah. So and you liked it?
I did. I liked it.
Yeah, you know, that was kind of...
The latest Star Wars movie. I enjoyed that. Because, you know, Star Wars came out in our childhood in 1977.
Dude. I've got my figures.
Yeah, see the R2-D2, Darth Vader.
Yeah.
I mean, that probably is the greatest movie of all time. It's got to be in the top five.
It's in my top three. Top five.
And the first one is better than all the others.
No, Empire Strikes Back is better than Star Wars.
No, I don't think so. The initial thing with Darth Vader and the confrontation between Darth Vader and his mentor, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, but have you gone back and watched it?
Yes, I have.
It doesn't really hold up.
Oh, it does hold up.
When you go back and you look at the ass-kicking fight that they had in, like, three...
Technological superiority does not trump enhanced storytelling.
No. The only problem is that when you watch them fight in four...
It's substance over style, not style over substance,
Mr. Rogers.
It's like
watching Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier fight in the old folks' home. You know, like,
but the dialogue, you know.
Yes, the dialogue. I mean, so what was your take on Seven? Were you a big fan of it? What do you think?
I was pleasantly surprised with it. I mean, it had a very similar plot to the first one, but, you know, it was... I'd waited so long, and I thought the middle... The first three movies I thought were great. The next three movies, yeah. So this came back a little bit. So it brought it back home for me.
So who do you think that big creature is that, you know, keeps projecting himself as large, but he's probably not very large, but he keeps making himself look like, you know, in the hologram, a great big thing.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yoda.
I think it's Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah. I don't know.
He's coming back to kill everybody for writing him out of the film.
Yeah. We gotta love Star Wars.
I do too. You know, and I still, like I said, I've still got my characters from 1977, a lot of them that I played with, and I still sort of play with.
I like the little Jawas.
Yeah. I always joke that I wanted to be in the next Star Wars. Now, I could play a Jawa. I'd be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, and I don't know. I guess I want to talk about you and your youth and how you got into doing law, because you're a well-known lawyer. You're very respected.
I would say I'm probably more of a legal journalist than a public speaker. Law was never my first love. History was. I'm like you. I like certain pieces of history. I know you were a big fan at one time of Roman history.
Absolutely.
Rome came out. I remember buying you the book Augustus.
Yeah.
I think. But I always loved history. I did very well in my history classes. I took a lot of Russian history even. And I was in college, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I toyed with the idea of becoming a history teacher. And I really owe everything to my father. My father lived by himself since he was 14, dirt poor in Kentucky.
And a doctor.
He's now a doctor, yeah. He's really a true self-made man, rags-to-riches type Horatio Alger story. He told me that he would pay for my graduate school. And so I went and talked to an advisor, and they said, well, maybe law school. So I tried the LSAT. I always have been good on standardized tests, and I got a 98 or 99 percentile on the LSAT, so I ended up going to law school and sort of fumbled around in law school, but got a law degree, passed the bar exam, and I worked for a judge for a year, and then I think I mentioned earlier, just was fortunate enough to find a place at the First Amendment Center, where I became more of a legal journalist and a writer. It was really the experience at the First Amendment Center, where I was required to write a story a day, that gave me, I think, better writing skills. There were actual editors there who would edit my work and carve it up. And that's how I became a writer, really, was working at the First Amendment Center. Mm. So I'm grateful for that.
Okay. And were you a childhood fan of boxing?
Absolutely. And I don't know why that is. My family jokes about, like, when my grandmother would keep me a lot, and she would, I guess people probably don't do this nowadays, but she would just dump, she'd have a bunch of errands to run, so she'd dump me off at the bookstore, and I would just read all the magazines in the bookstore, and sometimes the books. And she'd dump me off there for 2-3 hours at a time. And then they didn't really care, because she'd always buy something when she came back in. But I would read all the basketball and all the boxing magazines. And you remember back in the day when there were like 6 or 7 boxing magazines? I'd read all of them, and I'd read all the basketball magazines as well. And so I've always been a fan of both basketball and boxing.
Even though I was young and I was a fan of boxing, and my daddy taped everything and I watched everything, you know how I learned the most? I became a historian on boxing by, there was this game back in the mid to late 70s called Title Bout. And in the game Title Bout, you had all these little cards of all the boxers in every single weight division that you boxed, you know, that you rolled the dice and you boxed and everything with them. And I would read up on these guys, and I'd read their nicknames, and I'd read their bio, and I'd read what their records were. And I just, I learned so much about fighters and the sport of boxing through that. And then I would do that, and then I would like take books and like read about them in the further in the books. And I was just a big nerd, you know.
Me too.
And I like that stuff, and I've always liked that stuff. But you know, it's amazing that you have written 40 books. When did you publish your first book?
My first book was published in 2002. It was a short book on the Bill of Rights. Probably the most challenging thing I've ever written, because I had to write a book on the Bill of Rights for middle school students. And the Bill of Rights consists of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution ratified December 15, 1791. Mm-hmm. Right? Because when the Founding Fathers first ratified the Constitution in September of 1787, we didn't have a Bill of Rights.
So we Brexited before it was cool.
George Mason had, at the end of the convention, had said, why not a Bill of Rights? And they just got unanimously. But James Madison realized the political expediency of having a Bill of Rights, and Thomas Jefferson convinced him that we needed a Bill of Rights. And so the First Amendment is the first 45 words of the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment is obviously the next one. Fourth Amendment, which, if we have a Fourth Amendment anymore, is the one that protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. But I had to write about some of these fairly difficult concepts mm-hmm. on a middle school level. And that writing also helped me be a teacher, because that's probably what I am foremost, is I'm a teacher. I've taught at Southeastern Paralegal Institute, Middle Tennessee State University, Nashville School of Law, Vanderbilt Law School, and Belmont mm-hmm. School of Law. In order to be able to teach, you have to master your subject matter. And there's nothing like mastering your subject matter than writing a book about it.
Okay.
And so the writing kind of went hand in hand with the teaching, and I've always tried to maintain, you know, some presence in both teaching and in writing.
So when are we going to write a book together?
Well, I think that the one that I would like to have some hand in, although you may do it yourself, is I really enjoyed writing that piece about the Honky Tonk Hitman and Boxing Digest. And we had started it years back, and I'd even interviewed several people that you'd fought and some family members of yours. And then I think life events hit us both, and we just dropped it. I would love to get back on that project in some manner, even if I'm just a helping as a ghost editor or something. That'd be a dream of mine.
That would be a lot of fun. Speaking of which, you just said something that I wanted to bring up. I don't know if you remember this or not, but you did a interview with me with Fight News. And in that interview with Fight News, you asked me some questions, and I made a couple of bold predictions in them. This was in 2001. It was in September of 2001.
One, you said Bernard Hopkins would beat Felix Trinidad,
absolutely,
if I remember.
Yeah, and the
boxing world did not see. And that was the first time I was ever at your home. Mm-hmm. Because if you'll recall, I actually had tickets to the original fight.
Okay.
I had eighth row seats, and then 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that fight got pushed back 2 weeks till September 29th.
Mm-hmm.
I came over to your apartment. That time you lived in the Brentwood area,
okay,
kind of. And we came over to your apartment, and we watched the Hopkins-Trinidad fight. And you had called that fight maybe 6 months before. Bernard Hopkins was a master, and
that was a
pretty bold prediction at the time, because I think at that time a lot of people thought Trinidad
thought he was going to dominate Bernard Hopkins, and I was like, Bernard Hopkins is a complete fighter, and he's going to show Felix Trinidad he's going to take him places and put him in positions he's never been before, and people thought in the fight game thought I was absolutely an utterly crazy. Yeah.
You've been eerily accurate on your predictions. I hope that you've made a few wagers in Vegas, but if you had, you'd have even more money.
So I made one other prediction in this interview. So we were talking about commentators, and this is 2001, September 2001. We were talking about, you said to me, would you want to be a boxing commentator? And I said, absolutely, I would love to do that. That would be something right down my path. I think I would be fantastic at it. But I said, usually boxers don't make the best commentators. I said, I sometimes like to listen to George Foreman because he's amusing. I said, but for the most part, boxers just don't make the best commentators. I said, and I made this bold prediction. I said, there's a guy on ESPN right now. I said, you mark my words, that in about 10, 12 years, he's going to be the next Al Merchant. He's going to be the next big thing. His name is Max Kellerman.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, Max. I've always liked Max Kellerman. Yeah, he's very talented.
And
although you're selling yourself short, you are also a very talented ring announcer. I have seen for bouts, I think these are mainly amateur bouts. There have been bouts where you've probably put the whole thing together, but you also sing the national anthem and you announce the fighters.
Well, you know, that may be a combination of having to wear the hats that are needed because there's just not enough help to do the job. But, you know, I do have a decent skill set with which to pull from, and that makes me a little bit more lucky, I guess, if you will. So, I sell myself short. Hell, I guess I do. Most of the shit I do is for free.
right.
So, what's the latest book that you have coming out right now?
I'm working on a book now on the Tennessee Constitution with a really, really smart guy, Jeffrey Usman, who's a professor at Belmont Law School. So, I'm working on that. And then I'm also working on a book called sort of like taking a lot of the founding documents of the First Amendment or significant cases, and I sort of explain those. So I'm working on those two projects.
Did you ever finish the custody book?
Yes.
How'd that work out?
It was okay. That's part of a series for Chelsea House, which I think got bought by Facts on File. Those books, I think, have some educational value for students, but I don't get any royalties from those.
I could have written you an entire chapter.
Yeah, I know you know quite a bit about that.
Huge amount about custody law. Anyway, let's see, what else? Where can people go to buy your books, and where can they find stuff with that has to do with David?
Well, probably Amazon is probably the easiest. If you just type in David L. Hudson Jr., David L. Hudson Jr., you'll see quite a few books on there. Probably the book I would most recommend, and this would be for anybody who is a parent of a middle school or a high school student. I have a book that's been very favorably reviewed called Let the Student Speak, A History of the Fight for Freedom of Expression in American Schools. That book, published in 2011 by Beacon Press, is an excellent book. I have actual interviews with a lot of the actual litigants in the seminal student speech cases. And to me, that's one of my better efforts, was that book. I'm very proud of that one. I also have contributed to the Handy series. So I have a book called The Handy Supreme Court, The Handy American History Book, The Handy U.S. Supreme Court Book. Those I think I would recommend those as well. And then a book that I did with a great guy by the name of Mike Fitzgerald, who's a boxing judge from Wisconsin. We did a book that's a bit dated now. It was published in 2002 called Boxing's Most Wanted. Top 10 book of champs, chumps, and punch drunk palookas. And that book was really a favorite of mine. You actually helped with that book, if you remember. So I enjoy that book as well.
I think you actually even mentioned me in it.
Yeah, you are actually an entry in the book.
There you go. So. Man, I appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, I loved it, man. I wish I could do it again, man. If somebody cancels on you, I'll come out and do it again.
Listen to you. You're not sloppy, Sackers. Yeah, come on, man. Now we got to go play some cornhole.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do this thing.
Thank you, man.
I'm going to take your money.
Bye.
I'm taking your money, man.